My guest today is Abdu Murray. Abdu is a former Muslim who, after a 9-year investigation into Christianity, came to believe that the Christian faith can answer the questions of the mind and the longings of the heart. Abdu holds a Bachelor in Psychology from the University of Michigan. He earned his Juris Doctor from the University of Michigan Law School. And as an attorney, Abdu was named several times in Best Lawyers in America and Michigan Super Lawyer. Abdu hosts his own podcast called The Defense Rest, and he's the Senior Vice President of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries and the author of 3 books. He's now co-authored a new book with Ravi Zacharias titled Seeing Jesus from the East, and that's going to be our main topic of discussion for today. So I hope you enjoy this episode of Solid Faith. Abdu, welcome to the Solid Faith Podcast, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's actually, I'm really excited to do it. You have a fledgling podcast as it stands. You about a year, you said. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I'm honored to be on the ground floor of this whole thing, and I know you've had some great people on before me. So hopefully, you know, with all the bread that you've gotten people to be fed by, you won't get any bologna today.
Right. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, man. You know, I'm very familiar with your work. I've read several of your books, and most of my listeners that are into apologetics probably have as well. But those who haven't read your books, would you mind just giving them a brief synopsis of your own personal conversion story?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. And I'll give it a synopsis of it, because there's actually a much longer version of all this, obviously, as you can imagine, because the whole thing took 9 years, really, from the time when I was being witnessed to first and in earnest, and I began to really study and understand what the Bible has to say. Because I want to reject the real thing, you know. I don't want to reject the false thing. And for the longest time, I was rejecting a caricature of Christianity. From the time I began to study the real thing to the time I actually gave my life to Christ was about 9 years. So I'm going to compress that 9 years into a couple of minutes. I was raised as a Shia Muslim. You know, there's a lot of different kinds of Muslims. But the two main branches of Islam are the Shia and the Sunni. The Sunni being the majority, and the Shia being a bit of minority. And the reason for the difference really is political. It started off. There's a couple of theological differences, but they're more akin to differences in theology between like Baptists and Lutherans, that kind of a thing. They're both of the same strand of evangelicalism or Protestantism, as it were, in the Christian context. And Shia and Sunni are both Islamic, and they're both holding to the 5 pillars of Islam and the fundamental beliefs, but there are some slight differences. Well, I grew up believing that you should believe true things and you should reject false things. And I also grew up, I was a child of the 80s. I was born in the 70s, but I grew up and really came into, you know, sort of an awareness of the world around me in the 80s. And I was aware of this movement, you know, to believe things in a postmodern way. You know, it's true for you, it's great. If it's true for me, my truth is my truth, your truth is your truth. Never the twain shall meet unless I agree to it. But keep it to yourself. You know, don't foist your truth on me, as it were. Well, I would have none of that nonsense, because I believed that things were either true or they were false. And yes, there's shades of gray in terms of our understanding, but truth is still truth no matter what. And I thought Islam was true. So I took it upon myself to engage in conversations with people who weren't Muslims, and some Muslims too, by the way, some nominal Muslims, about why Islam was true. Now, I wouldn't do it antagonistically, and I wouldn't do it every 5 seconds. It would be conversational, you know. It would be in the course of my relationship with people. Or if I just met a Christian who was actually pretty serious about being a Christian, I would engage with them. And I'd often ask them a fundamental question. And that question was, why are you a Christian? And I was an equal opportunity faith knocker, outer ever. It wasn't just Christians I was going after, but they were sort of low-hanging fruit, you know, because I grew up in an area where religiously there was very little diversity. Actually, ethnically, there wasn't a whole lot of diversity either. We were sort of the dollop of olive oil in the pot of rice in the area I grew up in. Now it's extremely diverse. And growing up in the high school and all these things became more and more diverse. But back then it was mostly white Christians. And in the 80s and in the 90s, it was fashionable to say you were a Christian, even if you didn't mean it. It just meant not atheist or not, you know, Catholic or not Protestant or whatever, if you said whatever your denomination was. In other words, you didn't have to mean it. Well, so I asked Christians, why are you a Christian? And they would often say, I don't know, because I go to the, I guess I'm a Presbyterian because we go to the Presbyterian church. Or they'd say, I'm Methodist because we go to the Methodist church on Christmas and Easter. They would check with their friend, right? We go to the Methodist church, is that right? Something like that, you know? And I would say something like, do you even know? And they'd say, no, I don't know why I'm a Christian. I guess I was just raised that way. So my follow-up question always was, are you telling me that you trust your eternal soul to a worldview that someone else has thought through, but you haven't? And the answer was usually, yeah, I haven't thought through it. I said, oh, good. Well, because I have thought it through for you. Here's the reasons why you're wrong. Along the way, however, I began to run into some Christians who did know what they were talking about. This was sort of the, you know, reading the books on discovering things by Josh McDowell and in the late 90s, early 2000s, things by Greg Kokel and others. But Ravi Zacharias, who I now work with, his stuff started to seep in the mid-90s. I began to hear it. I even heard him actually, as Providence would have it, on a radio station in the middle of mid-Michigan after seeing a friend during my college days and driving back and there being nothing on a Sunday morning, driving back from mid-Michigan all the way to southeast lower Michigan for the numerous hours of the drive. Nothing on the radio. This is before podcasts, of course, and before iPods even, except for the scan button. And I would find Christian and country music on Sundays, and I didn't want to hear either one of those two things. So I found this Indian accented voice talking about Jesus, and I'm like, what is an Indian doing talking about Jesus? What is this? So I began to hear Ravi give a cogent explanation of the Christian faith, and I thought, this is actually worth thinking about. Well, it was during that time when some guys started coming to our apartment. Two guys, Dave and Pete were their names, two Baptist guys who were going door to door at the University of Michigan talking about Jesus. And I let them into my apartment. We had hours-long conversations. I made those two guys very uncomfortable because I had every objection I could possibly lodge at them. And sometimes they had answers. Other times they had no answer. And sometimes they had the best answer. I don't know. Can I get back to you? And then they did. Well, in an effort to debunk Christianity to these guys, I wanted to find a contradiction in the Bible that would actually be so powerful. And, you know, Jesus says X in Matthew, and he says not X in Luke, something like that. And I begin to look at it. So I'm reading Luke, and I find the verse of scripture, Luke chapter 3, verses 7 and following. And John the Baptist is talking to those who were coming to him, and he says, who told you to flee from the wrath to come? You know, God's judgment. And then he says, do not even begin to think to yourself you have Abraham as your father, for I tell you, God can raise up children of Abraham from the stones. Now, what he's saying there is tradition does not save you. Truth saves you. And that's what I had been saying to Christians. But in all that time, a Christian had never really asked me, why are you a Muslim? So I put him on the defensive all the time. Well, I had to ask myself that question, prompted by John the Baptist, which is, by the way, all kinds of poetic. Because I believed the Bible was corrupted. As a Muslim, I believed that the Bible was once God's word, at least parts of it were, but became corrupted over time, which is why the Quran was revealed to humanity. But here we have John the Baptist saying profound truths in a book that I thought was corrupted and that was actually carried aloft through history. We can find this. It was carried aloft by the Holy Spirit to be accurately transmitted down through the centuries so that I could hear the message. And that began the journey. I decided that day I was not going to just take every argument in favor of Islam and every argument against Christianity and just swallow it unthinkingly. I was going to put them all to the test. Confident Islam would win the day, but realizing that at some point a decision would have to be made. Well, years later, I came to that decision. And part of the problem was it didn't take 9 years to find the answers. It took a couple of years to find those. It did take 6 to 7 additional years for me to embrace the answers as true, because the reality is the answers are not hard to find, but they are hard to accept because they require you to change not only your worldview, but sometimes your affiliations and that which is deeply held in your life. And I didn't want to do that, but eventually I saw the beauty of it. And I saw something, if you'll just permit me 30 more seconds on this.
Sure.
Saw something gorgeous in the gospel. You see, as a Muslim, I believed in the idea of God's greatness. In fact, it is the pinnacle idea of all of Islam, that Islam worships a God who is the pinnacle of greatness. There is no being greater than God in Islam. So if God is the greatest possible being, well, then he would express the greatest possible ethic, which is love, and he would express it in the greatest possible way. That naturally follows, that logically follows. So if he doesn't express love, then he can't be God. And if he doesn't express it in the greatest possible way, then he can't be the greatest possible being. Then he wouldn't be God. So he must express it in the greatest possible way. What is the greatest possible way to express love? It's, of course, self-sacrifice. Everyone knows this. And that's where I saw Romans chapter 5, verse 8, speak to my heart and my mind simultaneously, so beautifully, for God demonstrates his love, his greatest possible love, in that while we were sinners, those who hate God, Christ died for us, the greatest possible being, expressing the greatest possible ethic in the greatest possible way. And that's when I became a believer.
Wow, man, that's an amazing story. And, you know, just listening to that, you mentioned that there are Christians who are not, they don't have a foundation, or maybe they're cultural Christians, meaning they've just gone to church all their lives. It's something they do, but it's not something they're just totally bought in or totally understand. And, you know, you bringing in a different perspective brings me to, you know, the main topic of our conversation today, which is the book that you've co-authored with Ravi. It's just been released, Seeing Jesus from the East. How did that project come about? I know there's sort of a backstory. I know Nabil Qureshi was involved in some of the, you know, the book, and maybe I think it was originally some of Nabil's idea to even start the book. So maybe you could give us a little brief introduction to how that project came about and how you got involved in Seeing Jesus from the East.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny because when Nabil and I would spend time together, we'd always spend time together doing two things, talking theology and eating food. It seemed like the two things we did incessantly, and sometimes at the same time and sometimes with our mouths full. So oftentimes when we would do that, we would talk about the way in which Jesus was surprisingly Eastern to us, considering that we once thought Jesus to be the Jesus of the Bible, to be a Westernized sort of McDonaldized version packaged for consumer consumption, ripped away from the East, that the Jesus of Islam was the real Jesus. He was the Eastern Jesus, and this Jesus of the Bible is this Western imperialistic Romanized Jesus. But we began to talk about how surprised we were about that. Well, along the way, as he was working with Ravi, it became a brainchild of Nabil's, actually. In fact, it wasn't even Ravi's idea to write this book. He wanted to write a book that really reoriented the perspective of who Jesus is from the Eastern perspective for two reasons. One, to sort of highlight again just how Eastern Jesus actually is, but also to help Westerners, not when we show how Eastern Jesus is, to point Easterners to Jesus. The Jesus that they think was hijacked by the Westerners is actually the Jesus of the Bible, who is the real Eastern Jesus. So this was his idea. And sadly, as we know, just before putting pen to paper to begin the project, Nabil contracted stomach cancer. And a year later, he passed. And that's been years now since he's been gone. It's been 2.5 years now since he's been gone, which seems unbelievable to me. But about 8, 9 months ago, I want to say 8, 9 months ago, maybe even a year, Ravi called me and said, Abdu, I know that Nabil wanted this book to be written, and I can think of no one else but you to write it, especially from the Islamic perspective, given my Middle Eastern background as well. So he asked me if I would write it with him. And of course, before he got the words out, I said yes. What an honor to write a book with Ravi Zacharias, of all people, the person who I heard providentially on a radio program I'm now writing books with, which is just poetic, again, all by itself. So the dedication is to Nabil. I called his wife, Michelle, his widow, of course, and I asked her for permission. I didn't need it legally, but I felt like I needed it just interpersonally to get her permission to say, I want to ask you for your blessing for me to be able to take the mantle up on this. And she was, of course, very much willing for that to happen. And we started putting pen to paper. Now, some of the chapters are different than the ones that Nabil had wanted to write in terms of some of the content, but some of them are exactly what he wanted to write in terms of the content, in terms of the themes. All the material is originally, obviously, with me, but we share the same story, coming from honor-shame cultures and these kind of things. So the book is dedicated to Nabil, Ravi put it so beautifully in the dedication, where he says, I'm going to paraphrase it, I don't have it memorized, but Ravi and I wrote it, and Ravi penned the last bit of it when he pointed out that Nabil so desperately wanted to write this book with us, but his eyes are now seeing Jesus in a way we could never hope this side of heaven, and he must be smiling at how little we'd actually know.
Wow. Yeah, what a beautiful tribute, man, to the work that Nabil has done. Nabil's book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, is one of the first books I picked up, and a lot of people who are not familiar with Eastern culture, and want to learn how to respond to Muslims if they have Muslim friends or family. So it was one of the first books I picked up, and I just thought it was really unique how this book came together. And it's just a really unique book in comparison to other books I've read. One of the things that is unique about the book is you bring these Eastern concepts to the forefront. And I think this is an Eastern and a Western thing, but it's typically thought of as an Eastern thing, and that is parables, teaching through parables. So you have a chapter in the book that I believe you wrote the chapter on parables. And I took a quote from the book. It said, "Parables based on sound logic do more than just teach us propositional truths. They employ characters and themes that immerse us into the truths being taught. Parables don't just teach us truth. Therefore, they also teach us about our relationship to the truth." And I just thought that was a really good statement. But how did parables, and maybe even the Eastern ones that you heard growing up, how did these parables maybe even impact your own conversion to Christianity or your understanding of God?
That's interesting because, you know, there wasn't a lesson in life that I can think of that was deep and fundamental that I didn't hear some parable from someone in my family who said, well, you know, and they give you this story and about how to be a good husband, how to buy shoes. We had parables for how to buy shoes, for heaven's sake. So it was laced everywhere. And it's not, you're right, you pointed out, it's not necessarily just an Eastern thing. It's a quintessentially Eastern thing, but it's also Western in the sense that movies today and novels, these are our modern parables because many of them try to teach us moral lessons. And in fact, I go into a couple in the book about the way in which you can see the gospel, even in Hollywood movies. I do believe the gospel is such a powerful message that we tell it by accident, even when we don't mean to. But, you know, back to your question, I remember, and Ravi tells about this one parable, this one story he heard growing up, and we had a similar one in the Middle East. There's the story of this young man who goes away from his parents' love, and he goes to meet a woman his parents do not approve of in terms of who she is to marry him. And he defies his parents in this. He absolutely eschews their logic, eschews their wisdom. They know the kind of person she is. They've seen what this kind of person can do to a young man. But he, you know, passion is passion, and he runs away from it. And soon the mother is there, and she's wailing for her son. And the new wife asks the mother's son for his loyalty, and says, "Do you love me more than your mother?" And he says, "I love you more than anything." She says, "Then bring me your mother's heart." And he goes and he cuts her heart out. And as he's running back, trying to run from his own guilt over what he's done, he trips and falls. And as he holds the heart in his hand, he can hear his mother's voice say, "Son, are you okay? Are you hurt?" And the whole idea is that there's no replacing a mother's love. Rash lust and passions can't replace it. What's interesting to me as I look back on it now, it never actually occurred to me to see this as a parable for God, because I would never conceive as an Easterner of a God who could be that self-sacrificial or a suffering God. In terms of not as an Easterner, but as a Muslim, I couldn't see it. But as I began to study the Christian faith, I began to look at these old parables and see a parent's love is unconditional. It doesn't depend upon the actions, or it shouldn't depend upon the actions or the beliefs or the creeds of the child. But a spouse's love can be quite conditional. You know, in terms of the way we think of, you know, marriage now, it's very much of a contract. You displease me, I can divorce you, it's over. But a parent can't. And that's what the parable is all about, is that no matter, even when you slay me, I will still love you. And then I saw that message in the gospel that God himself, even though we reject him, still loves us. Even though our sin is that which slays him, his heart still beats out, I want the best for you. And that's a parable that leads you there. And you can see yourself in that parable. That's why the parable of the prodigal son is so powerful, because we can see ourselves either as the prodigal son or as the dutiful son who resents the prodigal. You can see yourself in there. And so you learn multiple lessons from all these parables. So I remember that parable growing up and then seeing the import of it as I began to look in the Christian faith.
Yeah, you mentioned the mother's love, and one of the things that I picked up on that was a great theme all throughout the book was the Eastern emphasis on family, on culture, on your legacy. Whereas in the West, we typically put a higher emphasis on personal autonomy, liberation from anything that would hold you back. And so I saw, as I was reading the book, some pros to that Eastern concept. And I guess there is maybe pros and cons, either way. But what are
Yeah.
some of the pros and cons of the Eastern emphasis of family, of heritage, of culture?
Yeah. And what you've described is the honor shame culture that exists in the East. An honor shame culture, in a nutshell, is a culture in which the collective is more important than any one individual. And we know we say that all the time in the West too. You have like an armed services thing, one for all for one, kind of a thing, and you have this. There's no I in team. We have these kind of things, but in the East, it's beyond sports. It's everyday life. There is individualism in the East, but it is very much subordinated to the collective. So in an honor shame culture, a person will do that which brings honor to his family and to his community. Even if it's not necessarily true or it comports with the truth, he will still strive for that because it brings honor to his family and to his community, and therefore makes him an honorable person. He will also do things that avoid shame, even if avoiding the truth avoids shame. So if you've done something, you will hide it. Or if you have come across something that's true but might displease our parents or displease our community, we will run away from it because it will bring shame to the community and to the family. So it's all about honor and shame. And so the benefit of that is that it takes the locus of morality outside of the individual person and takes it outside and places the locus of enforcement into the community so that you care about how the collective is actually impacted. So it's great because in one sense you become selfless in a way. What you're doing is you're thinking, how will this impact others? And of course, it's funny because as we sit here today, we're all doing social distancing. And what is the common mantra we hear all the time? Is that if not for yourself, then for others. If you're healthy and you won't succumb to COVID-19, think of those you might infect. In other words, think of the collective. Well, this is part of the everyday experience in the East. So we have learned in the West, I think, something valuable from the East, which is to think of the collective. The downside of this is that oftentimes worrying about what the collective thinks creates a barrier to the actual truth, so that we never really see what the truth is because we always taint it or filter it through our lens of will this displease others? So we can reject something that's true, even if it is true and we're convinced it's true because of the shame it might bring. I remember, and I opened the chapter on honor and shame with a story of a young guy I met who admitted to me in every sense of the word that he knew Christianity was true. He literally said to me, "This is the truth." And he said it through tear-fauceted eyes. And I said, "What is the problem then?" And I knew what the problem was. It was a rhetorical question because I went through the same thing. And he said, "If I, like my father has never said he's proud of me. And if I become a Christian, he never will." And that's what held him back. He knew it was the truth, but could not give up the dream that his father would one day say, "I'm proud of you, son." And that's a very, very serious thing. So we want the pride of our parents. Who doesn't? But it's so strong in the East that oftentimes that can cloud what's actually true.
As I was reading through and reading about shame in the Eastern sense, this is something that I, from what I've read, many Muslims have a hard time understanding how Jesus could be the Savior, the Messiah, and yet die such a shameful death, a crucifixion, which is a humiliating death. But you kind of flip that on its head in the book a bit. I think you show how that's actually an honorable thing, even from an Eastern sense, maybe how there is redemption in that or honor in that in a way that, may not be seen at first glance. So how might an Eastern context actually benefit our Western understanding or idea of Christ's crucifixion?
Well, you see the profundity of it then, don't you? Because remember something, Jesus is Middle Eastern. He has olive skin, he has the woolly hair, he has the longer than Western nose. He's got these things, he's got the olive oil flowing through his veins, as it were. So this whole idea of God dying, incarnating and dying a shameful death, was born in a place where it likely should not have been born. In the very area where you're talking about, they would eschew this as an absolutely shameful thing. No way would God do this. And yet it happens, and it's born in the Middle East, which gives it an air of credibility, which means that it's not a product of its time. In fact, a colleague of mine, Michael Ramsden, was speaking with a leading atheist in the United Kingdom. And the atheist said to Michael Ramsden, it's obvious that Jesus's message is unique and special in history and in the world, because Jesus was obviously not a product of his time or his culture, which means that he did have some tinge of that in him, but he transcended it as well. And the very message of the cross, this idea that it's, foolishness to the Greeks and it is this shame to the Jews, shows you how unique it actually is. So you can flip it around and show one, its credibility, that this is unlikely to have been a made-up story by a bunch of Jews who wouldn't have thought of this idea unless it actually happened. So that's number one. But number two is that it flips the whole thing on its head, in that it isn't just that Jesus bears shame and dies a shameful death, that he bears that shame so that we won't have to, much like parents and family does in the Middle East. You see this all the time, where they will harbor the secret, and they'll have, if someone will do something shameful, and they'll keep that shame amongst themselves, and it'll fester in the family, and it'll actually affect the family, but they do it for the sake of the one who's done the wrong, to keep that from becoming out there and ruining the reputation of that person. Well, with Jesus, he's not keeping it in to keep you from having a ruined reputation. He's actually keeping it in. He actually takes out on your shame so that you will appear innocent and have his righteousness imputed to you and your shame imputed to him. But what he does also is he actually melds the two. He takes the judiciary role in the cross. What happens in the cross? Jesus is deemed, it takes our place as if he were a sinner and is judged. That's innocence and guilt, which is a Western idea. Not a Western idea, but it's a Western emphasis of innocence and guilt. So Jesus is deemed guilty and judged, and we are deemed innocent. But why is he deemed guilty? Because he takes on our shame, and we are considered honored now. So in the East and in the West, Eastern honor shame, Western innocence and guilt, they meld together in the cross. And so rather than say it is a shameful thing for him to die that way, it is actually something that shows the tremendous amount of love that God actually has for humanity. So first, you have credibility in the fact that this message would not have been born in an Eastern context, unless it was actually true. Two, you see that the shame that's taken upon Jesus is actually something as done as a gift for each one of us. But three, and this is the last one, is it doesn't end there. It doesn't end in a shameful death. It actually ends with a resurrection from the dead, that these ideas of shame and death and guilt and all these things have no hold on him. So while he takes them on, he frees us from it. And that's the peace that we're given. That's why Jesus walks into the locked room where Thomas is there, and he's shaking, doesn't know what to do. And the first thing Jesus does when he shows him the nail scars, he says, "Shalom Aleichem, peace be unto you, that I have overcome shame, sin, and death for you."
Yeah, you talk a lot about the sacrifices that you've personally had to make and that other Muslims have to make. Once you see the truth of that, once you see the truth of the gospel, once you see the truth of the power of the resurrection and what it means for us as humans, you talk about the sacrifices you've had to make, but I remember, and you have a wonderful dedication to the 21 men who were executed for their faith by members of ISIS. And the video circulated everywhere, and people, unfortunately, as graphic as it is, had access to it. And I still have the images in my head of those Christians who gave their life that day, seemingly unfazed. I don't know how they had that type of strength and courage and bravery. And as I was reading that, thinking as a Westerner, there are times where, maybe somebody criticizes me for being a Christian, but it's nothing compared to that. I've never, in my lifetime, I've never been, in threat of violence or, for fear for my life or anything of the sort, whenever I stand for my faith. So, what can Westerners learn about sacrifice from our Eastern brothers and sisters who face it more often and more severely?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because as I was writing the chapter on the rewards of sacrifice in the book, the BBC World Service actually put out a story on a finding commissioned that shows that the persecution of Christians around the world is now nearing a genocide. I'm not sure why it's almost a genocide as opposed to an actual genocide, but it is now nearing genocidal proportions. And the world seems to remain silent on it. We just simply don't say anything about it. I don't know why that is. I suspect it's because Christianity has been seen as big brother. I don't mean spying. I mean like it's been like the big invincible sort of hulking behemoth we can actually make fun of. It's like the Ivan Drago of the Rocky IV movie, kind of a thing where we can make fun of it and we can chop it down because it's big and it can take it. But the reality is, in the rest of the world, that's not the case. So what we can learn, I think, from all this is one, to put our own suffering in perspective. That's an important thing for us to do, to put our own suffering in perspective. But two is to gain strength from this position, from seeing what's going on. Because here's what I want to say, okay? The East and the West are looking more and more like each other every single day. Every single day, I see more and more of it. We think that it's only an Eastern thing where you have an honor and shame culture, but I beg to differ. We have this new phenomenon called the cancel culture, where we no longer engage in spirited debate or fact-based or argument-based debate over an issue. If you're a sports star, if you're a musician, if you're an actor, or just a run-of-the-mill person, if you happen to say something that runs afoul of the approved wisdom of the culture, they don't engage with you in argument. They simply cancel you altogether. They won't see your movies anymore. They'll stop talking to you. They'll stop talking about you. They'll talk bad about you. In other words, they'll shame you out of your opinions. That's very Eastern. And we're now catching up to what the Easterners have been doing for 2,000 years, 4,000 years, 5,000 years. so it's not like we can't learn something from this. What we can learn from what those men went through is that they went through more than just an honor and shame issue. They went through martyrdom. I mean, paint the picture in your minds. All of us can see it, right? We can see 21 men in bright orange prison jumpsuits, and they're made to kneel on the shores of the Mediterranean Ocean in front of men who are literally robed in darkness. They're literally covered head to toe in black. And they're told, if you renounce your faith, you'll live. If you don't, we'll take your heads. And all of them say, Ya Yeshua, Yeshua, which means Jesus in Arabic, to a man. Now, that wasn't a strength that came from them. It just simply wasn't. You know the empirical data, you see it all the time. In fact, they did an interviewer interviewed the chief executioner of a country I won't name. And they asked, they do a lot of public executions by beheading in this particular country. And they asked him, what's it like? And he says, you know what's interesting is that no matter how rough and tumble, no matter how mean and nasty the condemned is, or how genteel and white collar their crime may have been, whenever we go to pick them up from the cell, to walk them to the block where they'll lose their head, they stand up defiantly only to have their knees crumble underneath them. He says, their strength drains away. And yet you have 21 men, young guys, all sit there on their knees, and they're told, you can just say one sentence and you'll live. And none of them do. Where does that strength come from? I think it comes from what the Bible tells us, that we can believe with a depth heretofore not understood by Westerners. When Paul tells us in Philippians that we can do all things through Christ who gives us strength, He doesn't mean pass that exam. He doesn't mean find the girl of our dreams. He doesn't mean just to save our, he means all those things. And we can save our marriage and all, he means all that. But what he also means is face reality, even when it's not going to end well on this side of heaven. That's what he means. And then he says, we're more than conquerors. And so what do you remember of that video? Do you remember the ISIS guys? No. The guys emblazoned in orange are the ones who stand out. How poetic is it that ISIS was trying to humiliate those men, and yet they're the ones who shone brightly, literally. And their legacy lasts.
Wow.
What does their legacy tell me? That one, we will be persecuted or at least have some trouble because of our faith. Two, that we'll find an identity in Christ we would not be able to find on our own strength. Those men couldn't have stood up to that on their own strength, but they had a strength that was foreign to them that came from Christ. And three, that strength leads to an unshakable faith. Each one of us wonders, what would I do if a gun was put to my head? Or if I had to renounce my Christianity in order to gain some favor professionally or socially? Would I stick to my guns? Well, those 21 men did, not because they were extraordinary, but because they put their faith in the one who is.
Yeah, just again, when I read that tribute that you did, and again, it was a beautiful tribute to those men. But when I read that, it's just so powerful, the strength that they were given from God, that they could endure in the face of that, and it paints a light that I'm not sure from the West. Maybe we need to read those stories or revisit those stories as a reminder of what things are like in other parts of the world, because so many of these stories aren't told. And I think there's this strong misconception about what Christianity is. Christianity, by many Western standards, is thought of as an imperialistic religion that's devised by white males to dominate and control dark-skinned people. And I pulled that quote from your book because I thought that was a good way to describe a Western perspective of Christianity. An imperialistic religion that is devised by white males to dominate and control dark-skinned people. And when I see those men standing on the shore, I couldn't disagree more. But my question is, how have Westerners misunderstood Jesus because of the tendency to see things as, or Christianity as, an imperialistic religion?
Well, I think it's, you look at our history, and you look at the way in which people look at the Roman history, for example, and they started with Constantine. It's always Constantine's fault. Everything's Constantine's fault. Is that the minute that the church became the official religion of the Roman Empire, and Rodney Stark, by the way, has put the lie to this whole thing, that Constantine actually employed pagans as well as Christians in the highest levels of government. He never actually made it the instituted religion, official religion of the Roman Empire. That came much later. But we start with this narrative that because Paul went western, he went westernly, and the message spread into Europe, we forget that it spread into the East very, very quickly. And there's a huge heritage of Christianity in the East all the way to China. We forget this. Mm. So we have this thing in our heads, and I think we've also conflated evangelical Christianity with political parties and with certain agendas. I think that Christendom has something to answer for when it comes to that, because we're at least partly to blame for that perception. It's not only it's a misperception, but it's not completely a misperception. So I think that's part of it. And of course, colonialism and using the banner of Christianity to engage in colonialism has that. But we've misunderstood so much of the message, because what is the heart of the actual history? An olive-skinned man in 3 short years transformed so many people's lives, and his message impacted so many people. A small band to begin with that exploded in Judea, in this sort of forsaken outpost of the Roman Empire, spreads up into Asia Minor, spreads across Europe, as it's even spreading in the East, and captures the hearts and minds of the Romans. Now, here's what I want to say to you. One last thing about this. Rodney Stark points this out as a matter of history. David Bentley Hart talks about this as well. The very idea of human equality, as an example, didn't even occur to our pre-Christian pagan ancestors. It's not that they found the idea laughable. It's that they found the idea inconceivable. It never would have occurred to them. In fact, the word person comes from the Latin persona, which means mask. Personhood is an artificial thing placed on you by the state, and you have to prove your worth, and therefore inequalities are abounded. It was the Christian message from the olive-skinned people that influenced the whiter-skinned people to embrace this idea that all are equally made in God's image, all are equally sinful before a holy God, but all are equally offered salvation. It is the equality of the Christian message that infected, infiltrated, and then I think turned around for the good, the Roman Empire. We wouldn't have the institutions of equality that we strive for today, imperfectly so, if it wasn't for our pre-Roman forebears.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you mentioned earlier that you've met Christians, especially in your own personal conversion journey, that don't understand the foundations or the pillars of Christianity itself. So if we as Christians can't address these things, then it's always going to be problematic as far as sharing the gospel with others. Ravi wrote this, and it's the last question I have for you, but Ravi wrote in one of his chapters, he said, "Unfortunately, many in the West have changed this message into a westernized product, losing the Eastern perspective." He adds that in the West, we've wedded the philosophies of postmodernism and Eastern mysticism, neither of which has truth as its foundation stone. And I know that that's a big question. There's a lot to unpack there on that. But you wrote an entire book, Saving Truth, on postmodern thought. And so we could spend a ton of time on that. But just in a nutshell, how have we in the West embraced postmodernism, even as Christians maybe, and even Eastern mysticism in regards to our understanding of God?
You know, C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters has the master demon as he's training the junior demon how to lead people astray, as he says, play on their horror of the same old thing. And people get very, very tired of what they consider to be the same old thing. And so postmodern thinking has this seemingly deep but ultimately vacuous philosophy that all truth is relative and that it's more of a conversation than it is an imposition of truth claims or a battling of truth claims. Along comes Eastern mysticism, which becomes repackaged by Eckhart Tolle and Oprah Winfrey and Deepak Chopra and all these folks, Marianne Williamson, et cetera, to suddenly look like it's a Christianized idea that truths are all relative and your experience of God is personal to you and that's the most important thing. In other words, they're chastising what has been deemed to be the same old thing. Christianity is a dusty old religion written by dusty old people to try to control women and brown people, kind of a thing. But the reality is that every system of belief, even postmodernism, will tell you that essentially through your own inherent goodness, you will achieve some state of utopian nirvana, whether it's be through the dialectic approach, or it's through karma, or it's through devotions, or it's through religious systems, you will eventually please God or become God yourself. Christianity specifically teaches that that's the cardinal sin. The exact opposite is the truth, is that we are incapable of saving us from us. We're the problem. We need someone who's not us to save us from us. So if you want to go with something that's not the same old thing, Christianity is the only game in town. So to the postmodern who looks for that which is countercultural, you need look nowhere else other than Jesus, the ultimate counterculturalist. Yet he also respects the idea that truth is the fundamental basis. So in Saving Truth, one thing I do point out is that I think we're not really in postmodernism anymore. Postmodernism was the idea that there is no such thing as truth. And of course, that's easily debunked. You know from your own studies and the work you've done in apologetics and understanding how argument works that this is self-defeating. The minute someone says there's no such thing as truth, that statement itself has to be true. If it's true, then it's false. And if it's false, then why'd you say it? The whole thing is self-defeating. We're now engaged in what's called post-truth thinking. Post-truth doesn't say truth doesn't exist. What post-truth says is truth does exist, but I'm autonomous. I am a law unto myself, which is what autonomy actually means. And if I'm autonomous, then my preferences matter more than the truth. So truth might exist, and I will like it, and I will champion it when it fits my autonomous preferences. Mm-hmm. But the minute it goes against my preferences, I suddenly don't like it anymore, and I make it the bottom shelf, or I lie about it altogether. I think that's what's happened in our day as well. And so we take this idea that truth is a conversation and is relative from the East, And we think that suddenly we're being deep and more cosmopolitan in our thinking, when the reality is, if you want to be cosmopolitan in your thinking and you want to go back to the original truth person, you go to an Easterner, you go to Jesus, and you find it there.
Abdi, this has been just a super informative, effective conversation. I really enjoyed getting to hear from you, and I enjoyed the book. If you're a listener, I'm going to link the book up to the YouTube channel, and but those who are listening maybe by podcast, where can my listeners go if they want to get the book or if they want to find more of your work?
Absolutely. You can go to seeingjesusfromtheeast.com, and there's the book there. There's also a video curriculum coming out and some additional materials you can get there. So I think even some free content, if I'm not mistaken. So seeingjesusfromtheeast.com, but also just go to rzim.org, look me up. We've got a wonderful website where you can search all kinds of materials, from articles to videos to you name it, on various apologetics issues, and of course our own YouTube channel as well. So seeingjesusfromtheeast.com, rzim.org, go to see us on YouTube, look up RZIM there, and you type in my name, you'll see a playlist with my videos and our other wonderful speakers as well.
Okay, man, this has been great. I really appreciate you taking out some time for us, man.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Like I'm inside a sport. I pop a willy and move. I pop a willy and move. I pop a willy and move it. Continuous will of my music. Gassed up, you get passed up if you talk down. Get strapped up, got a sheet mask, I just move around.